it's possible to see the agenda of the Bible as the central agenda as being an issue of place. And I will outline here to give you an idea. Because of that, it's going to be difficult to make a case for it thoroughly today, because we'd have to go from cover to cover. And so what I want to do is just sketch in the broadest outline and talk a little bit about the relationship of Israel to place throughout the history. And I'll suggest it to you as an outline for understanding the literature of the Bible. And I found it to be very helpful. And in talking about the Hebrew attitude toward place, we'll also discover some values that are connected with it, and attitudes depending upon whether the Hebrews were in a place or were not in a place, or, you know, were either exiled or at home. And we'll look at one text in particular, and that's in Deuteronomy 8, as sort of a representative of a particular time when Israel probably faced the most dramatic and maybe the most germane challenge about being landed and settled. And it's the most germane to our own situation. One of the sources for it is a book that's in the bookstore by Walter Brueggemann called The Land, and I'll essentially use his outline here. Okay. I find in the last couple sessions of the program, the Bible stories remembered from the Old Testament, if you haven't read it in the last 5 years, they get all jumbled up. And they didn't, you know, nobody remembers who is who and when it happens. This outline hopefully will help correct that a little bit. I said yesterday that a flurry of writing and dealing with the memory of Israel happened in the exile. That all the promises, the major promises that Israel was remembering and clinging to and that characterized God for them, was that God would bring them out of slavery into freedom, into their land, which is flowing with milk and honey, the land of Canaan. And it was the loss of that expectation, that promise, the loss of the land after probably nearly 500 years of history that caused or 500 or more years of history that caused the probably the greatest crisis in the religion of Israel. What had happened before that was a long period of landed existence. Israel was a nation. And it began when Joshua brought the troops in somewhere around 1000 BC and ended when Babylon finally razed the walls of Jerusalem in 597 BC. They had kings. This is the period of time talked about in the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. All kind of a view from the exile looking back and wondering what happened in our history here that ended in the exile. And that's the question that they're dealing with and looking at that history. And I'll just write some kings, David, Solomon, prophets. All this sort of thing happened in this particular time, this particular period. Okay. Remember the period of time before this, the word to characterize it. Wilderness. And the time before the wilderness?
Exodus.
Captivity. Okay, Exodus goes with this. And the time before captivity. This is in Egypt. The earliest stories, probably the earliest memories, and that is the time of the patriarchs and matriarchs. The time of sojourning. Sojourning means to be a stranger in a place, to not have any kind of investment in it, to be dependent upon the inhabitants for your livelihood. And that's how Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah Jacob and Rachel and his other family existed. After exile, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah was a time of restoration. And it's at this point that things began to move toward the biblical pluralism, or the New Testament time, when there was a lot of pluralism at the time of Jesus. Restoration was after the exile had been digested and certain decisions had been made about how Israel existed in the land. At this time, certain decisions were made about how they would try it again. Okay. It was in the exile that they began to tell the stories about Abraham and how Abraham came to be in the land. And it talked about the Exodus and all the kinds of things that Moses taught the people in order that they could come from the wilderness into the land and live in it successfully and faithfully. And that was very relevant for this situation, because the people who were captive in Babylon, facing now a return to a ravaged and war-torn country, now had to do the same sort, had the same sort of program before them, in that they were leaving captivity, going through a short wilderness trip, and arriving again in the land to be landed. There's a significant difference between these two programs, and we'll talk a little bit about those. And there was not any kind of unanimity about restoration, because there were some that were not exiled, some that were still inhabitants. And there was a lot of tension that grew up between them. There were between the true Israelites, which came back, the ones in captivity, were the Benjaminites and the Judahites that could identify their lineage, the ones that were back in the land. Because the new program included racial purity, there was some question about this generation that remained and maybe married with the Canaanites, and that they were rejected from the true Israel. So there was that tension. There was also the influx of Greek culture around 300, it was a couple hundred years after the Restoration, and a couple hundred years before Jesus, of Roman culture. They were a captive people, and there was no sense in which they were their own, they were their own political entity as they were before. And so that brought about other sorts of tensions in their view of themselves. And what happened was you ended up with many parties that are familiar to you from the New Testament. You had the Pharisees, which were sort of a group that was apolitical, or attempted to be a group that that obeyed the Torah. It was a lay movement. You had the Sadducees, who were the Herodian compromisers. They were people who had made peace with the Roman authorities and found themselves in the leadership positions. Then there were Zealots, a movement growing out of Galilee, which insisted on political independence and that they would bring in the kingdom of God by any force necessary, by throwing out the Romans. There were Essenes, who went off into the desert and waited for the rapture. Who, interestingly enough, when the Zealot movement began, that ended in the stand at Masada, that was around 66 AD, it's believed that the Essenes finally thought it was happening and left the desert and joined them to fight with them. The Dead Sea Scrolls are believed to be the documents of the communities of Essenes. There were probably other parties with a self-identity. The one that one that's most relevant to us is one that was called the Way, the followers of the Rabbi Jesus. All of these adopted a particular aspect, you know, struggled with the memory and came up with some sort of selective way of evaluating it and understanding what the future would be like. The destruction of the temple in 70 AD eliminated all but two options. Pharisaic Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism continued, and the movement that came to be called Christians continued. They were the ones that could exist without the existence of a land and the home base, you know, of Israel and the temple. And I think now that Israel is once again a political entity. You're seeing something that resembles the zealot option in Zionism. And I don't know enough about modern Israel, but there is once again a movement within Judaism that insists that the land is crucial and central to the existence of Jews. Now, what I want to do is try to characterize with your help what you remember about Israel's existence in all this. And let me say, first of all, that Israel had always hoped to be in the land. That was always their greatest hope. In the times when they weren't in, when they were in captivity, they longed for deliverance. In the wilderness, they always clung to the promise that they would come into the land flowing with milk and honey. In exile, they hung up their harps and wept when they thought of Zion, Psalm 137. Longed for freedom from Greek and Roman occupation. And modern-day Judaism, until the existence of Israel, had a saying during their festivals to end the festivals next year in Jerusalem. Always the hope of returning to the land. Okay, the one I want to look at particularly is the contrast between these two, because this is the one I said was real germane to our situation. And this is when we'll look at the text in just a minute of Deuteronomy 8. What do you remember about the wilderness? You all saw Charlton Heston as Moses in the Ten Commandments, didn't you?
Sure.
I remember seeing it when I was 8, first time.
These guys didn't even warn you.
I know. I saw it in the movie theater, right? Not on TV. Actually, I'm going to include it with here. Maybe this would be, it would be maybe more easy to look at the three of these things here. And maybe these two would be the easiest ones to remember, because the story of the Ten Commandments and the story of Pharaoh and Moses are a very similar kind of contrast between this and what Israel found, the situation Israel found itself in here. They left captivity in a very managed, controlled, secure society, entered a precarious existence in the wilderness, and then were faced with becoming Egypt all over again, which was a very odd situation for these wilderness wanderers to get themselves into. So let's just think back on the Bible stories and kind of characterize them. Think of adjectives.
A lot of complaining and unfaithfulness.
Complaining. Okay. Unfaithfulness.
God's faithfulness.
Okay. Yeah, God had a share of anger too, but
yeah.
Always pulled through, right?
Yeah, he always did. Coming back.
Quail flying 3 feet off the ground.
Quail? Yeah. It was after the quail came through that they found the manna on the ground, huh? Which makes you ask some questions about exactly what it was.
Idolatry.
Idolatry? Now, which side? I started right here. Is this where?
Yeah.
Okay. It's so interesting.
In the land, too.
Interesting that the prophet said that this is one of the troubles with being in the land.
So he's complaining.
Unfaithfulness belonged over here.
Mm-hmm.
Complaining? I'm going to put a question mark. It's very obvious in the story that the complaining, the murmuring, I think that's the word they use, is characterizes the wilderness wanderer. Yeah. I don't know if it's as obvious in the other.
Wouldn't the wilderness be a bit more democratic society than the monarchy that was established?
Okay.
Into the land.
Okay.
I mean, the authority would have been spread out a little bit more, or not.
Maybe one aspect was that it's much more equalitarian.
Okay.
Everyone was a sojourner, and nobody had any more than they could get on the back of their camel or in their ox cart. The question of authority, it seemed to rest in Moses. And in that way, it was sort of, in one way, absolute. But it also differed in character from the kind of hierarchy one found in Egypt, which was centered in Pharaoh, and also the hierarchy that developed under the king in Israel. Huh? I haven't thought about it as far as its political organization. Moses seemed to be kind of an autocrat. Other things. Remember what in Egypt? Remember anything about Egypt?
Lots of. They all worked and they all ate. But.
Okay. They had food.
Yeah, they had food. Okay.
Lots of it. Remember that there was a text not too long ago where they talked about the leek and the garlic and the onions that they ate? Mm-hmm.
So they worked hard.
Hard work.
Yeah. Well, slavery, actually.
Yeah, and they said they made them serve with rigor. Yeah. And I think the fact it was not so much that the work was hard, but that they called it bondage, right? Now, in some ways, I have an interest in getting work off the hook. You know, that it wasn't that they were working out in the wilderness, they didn't have to work. But that they were working, supporting, their work was looked on as slavery. Now, I don't know exactly where to go from that, but that's the word, that bondage and affliction was what they called it. Story doesn't tell how they got themselves into that position. Genesis leaves off that Jacob brought all his sons down to be under Joseph's, you know, economic umbrella. And then Exodus starts with, and there arose over Egypt a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, and they oppressed Egypt, and, you know, 400 years of history is just compressed like that.
Which tells you that they had trouble with their political system.
The same
way. Or there wouldn't have been pharaohs over them like that. Hmm.
They came down as sojourners into Egypt, and they came down as dependents.
Were they still then sojourners of the entire 400 years?
No one really knows. There's very little biblical information and very little corroboration outside of, I just don't know.
Well, the pharaohs were very wealthy because it says that in one of the lessons we've had recently, or near it anyhow, that they took everything, they despoiled it when they left. They took all of the, they didn't have time enough to take the leavened bread, but they had time enough to take all the gold and stuff that was all over the place because they took everything they could get.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it always occurs to me that you wonder if somebody isn't kind of just gussing up the story a little bit to show how great Israel
was. Well, I always wondered until I just noticed that how they got all the gold and stuff to melt down to make their false idol when Moses was on the mountain and put in their ark and.
Yeah.
But they just took it from the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. In the land you had ladies, there's like real class division, there's ladies as bad as cows, and then there's poor people at the gate.
Okay. Opposite the equality of the wilderness is the kind of class divisions, huh? And you were talking about the cows of Bashan that wasn't very complimentary, that I think it was Amos that he called the court women of the northern kingdom. Yeah. All right, any other kind of characterization? Yeah.
Well, I remember when they were in the wilderness, or when they were leaving Egypt, God showed himself to the Egyptians through the, the plagues, and then also through the crossing of the Red Sea. That was a message that spread into a lot of other nations that Yahweh was the God of Israel.
Okay, the story of God's mighty works went out among. I don't know exactly how to write it down. I could write it down one way, and you could comment that those in the land experienced God's presence and activity as a judgment, as wrath of some sort, and that Israel in the wilderness experienced God's activity as oftentimes judgment, but it was also a kind of a nourishment and a caring too. Was that?
Yeah. I don't know, something about the fact that he was, at the time of the exile, but the leaving Egypt and during the wilderness, he was also speaking to other nations as well. And I don't know about while they were in the land, how much he was interacting with other nations as
okay.
Yahweh.
Good point. That God with us, God was a sojourning God in a way that whose fame could go out to other nations that they passed through, and God was not tied to a place, okay? I think there's vestiges of that in the story of David, when David wants to build a temple and the prophet comes to David and says, God does not live in houses. You know, God cannot be domesticated. God is a sojourner.
There's lots of evidence of that. The empty room where in the Holy of Holies, and
one of the things is that it was a tent.
Right.
During the wilderness, a portable tent. And it wasn't that God lived in it, but that his glory would descend upon it as sort of a show and tell.
When they were there ready.
Yeah. Opposed to that, the gods of Egypt were gods that were gods of the land, right? They were gods that had a particular geographical area. At least that's...
Mm-hmm. Or the water, or the air, or some specific...
Yeah, God's specialist kind of gods, you know. That gods had their own territory. It's one of that probably is a real crucial point in the program that Moses was trying to hammer into the heads of people, that your God is not a God like the gods of Egypt or the gods of Canaan. But your God has no home. Your God sojourns with you. And you can see if you read the stories of the three first kings of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon, you go from an understanding of God as a sojourner to where Solomon builds a temple and God becomes a servant of the state. Okay? And it's very apparent that from Solomon's time on, and this is one of the reasons that the prophets arose, was that the religious establishment was an arm of the state. And that might be the primary reason that the prophets came and took the risks they did and said what they did.
That was still going on into the New Testament, too.
Yeah, does it go on today?
Oh, yeah.
Moral majority jumps to my mind, you know,
yeah.
That those that have to, you know, that
crystal comes.
Yeah, the religion legitimates the state in order for the state to protect the religion. And there's kind of a very uneasy or an easy partnership in that way. And one of the very big contrasts between wilderness and land was that God sojourned with the people in the wilderness. And God became domesticated and enclosed in a temple and protected and managed by the government. It was when they entered into exile that question was opened up again, because they lost their temple. Jeremiah was the great prophet of God's freedom, saying that just because you have the temple does not mean that you own God. And time again, he committed both heresy and treason in saying that this temple can be destroyed and God can leave you and God can break the promises. And he was imprisoned for that and socially ostracized. It was also the latter parts of Isaiah that, again, remember that God is a sojourner and God of the entire world. And that, when in the third Isaiah, it talks about the suffering servant that is there for all people. And there's kind of a universalism that becomes apparent, where, especially at the time, one of the movements, or the dominant movement, was to shrink in again and become just a nation with a peculiar identity that owned their God. The books of Ruth and the book of Jonah are ones that speak against that sort of owning of God. Jonah, in that Jonah is asked to speak to a pagan nation, and God says, I can have compassion on those people as well as Israel. The story about Ruth, who was a Moabitess, a non-Jew, one of the Goyim, and she turns out, in the last little ironic turn of the phrase at the end of the book, to be the great-grandmother of their great King David. Any other kind of contrast between the two?
Let's say in the wilderness they were poor and very weak.
Okay. Weak, vulnerable, precarious, poor. Okay. Contrasting in the land, there were classes, but some became very rich and secure. Walter Brueggemann points out in Deuteronomy that along with the security comes the greatest danger to the to a people who live with a memory, and that is they get amnesia. They forget. Okay. Moses pounded all this stuff into the people's heads in the wilderness, and it took 40 years. And it's...
He still didn't do a good enough job
to
get to go in himself.
Yeah, right. And it was obvious that it didn't hold as well as it might. The story is told about that wilderness is not necessarily an ideal, that's where we ought to be. We ought to be itinerant. Because it talks about the bitter complaining and the murmuring and the unfaithfulness that accompanies this sort of precarious existence. Okay, so it isn't an ideal. And nowhere does it harken back to that we should again go out and be sojourners again. It is talked about all through the history and probably exemplified in Jesus' life that there are times to go, and especially in the book of Deuteronomy and the tapes by Walter Brueggemann, times to go to the edge of the wilderness and to look back and remember what your ancestors in the faith have learned about wilderness existence, and then to enter back into the land. Moses pounded and pounded this into the heads of Israel, that this is what it was like in Egypt. This is what it was like in the wilderness, and to follow their God. And then they came to the edge of the promised land, and they were giving up a way of life that had taught them this, and they were entering into a land that had all these temptations and all these kind of freighted risks. And the big question was, how, when we have this identity, can we live in the land? Okay. It's a question that Israel wrestled with in all their experience. And in the writing of the books of the Bible, when Jesus came along, Jesus lived this kind of a life. And yet, Paul and the other preachers for the New Testament did not claim that we should all be itinerant nomads. Paul was very, very big on talking about being responsible to your place, you know, staying in your family, taking care of your wife or your husband or your children, or the disadvantaged in your community and town. And of course, in the ancient world, like I said, there was no mobility and everyone was stuck where they were at. So the question was, how with this identity do you live in the land? And it's probably the question for us too. How do we live as weak and poor, precarious people, aware that God is leading us, shunning class divisions and the kind of wealth and security that the land provides, to live on quail and manna when we own the bakery? I guess there's a final kind of way to talk about this. Let's look at Deuteronomy 8, if you have a Bible there. Let me read the... I'll read it to you. You don't... All the commandments... Now, Deuteronomy is a book that's set on the boundary here, on the edge of the wilderness. Brueggemann says, Moses stops after 40 years and takes them and stops and talks to them for 26 chapters. And he comments that you'd think the people would say, isn't he about finished? And whether the book was written just previous to the exile in the last days of the troubled kingdom, or whether it was the work of Moses, the point is the same. Chapter 8, all the commandment which I command you this day you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers and mothers. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that he lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothes did not wear out on you, and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as one disciplines their children, the Lord your God disciplines you. You shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him. For the Lord is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and springs flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the land he has given you. But take heed lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes which I command you this day, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built goodly houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied, and that you and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna which your parents did not know, that he might humble you and test you to do you good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant which he swore to your fathers, mothers, as at this day. And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you this day that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. You get the feeling that Israel has entered into a crisis. To become landed has all sorts of risks. Yes, it's 9:45, and what I'd like to do now is to talk about, as a discussion, to talk about the connection between work and place
and to maybe go back and talk about the things that we have we've talked about in the previous session. I have the feeling right now that the connection between place and your work is not real clear. Is anyone okay? So maybe to say a couple of words about that. Do you remember? I think Monday we read some things about Sabbath for the land. That every 7 years the land should have a Sabbath to keep it healthy and to allow it to produce. There was also talk about some of the prophets, when they began to talk about the inequalities in work and riches, they talked about the land being the thing that suffered, and that the result of the policies of exploitation and stratification of class and that would end with the consequence of losing the land. And probably the most important thing that makes the connection is the land belongs to the Lord. And Israel had been put into the land in order to maintain the health of the community, being put into the land so that they would have a continuous source for daily bread, and they'd been put into the land not because they deserved it, but because God was the one who owned the land and God had given it to them as a gift, so it was undeserved. And the consequence of the social practices of Israel was not only social inequality and suffering on the part of the poor, but eventual loss of the land. Now, I feel like we have a lot of trouble in understanding, first of all, that Israel held the place most dear. And their commitment to the land was very, very strong, and their obligation to it was felt very strongly in their literature. When Jesus came along, the understanding of the land and the Holy Land, the place that God had given, was changed quite a bit. In some ways, it was outright rejected, and it was replaced, the object of the people's affection in some ways became Jesus. That instead of being a geocentric faith, it became a Christocentric faith. It became spiritualized, and it was a kingdom that was to come rather than the place that exists now. But it was also it was universalized in a way, in that Israel at the time when Jesus had a way of talking about the Holy Land being the center, most holy, Jerusalem and then Israel and then the outlying territories, and then the least holy land was that in the fringes, and I suppose the least would be the continent undiscovered on the other side of the world. The coming of Christ in a way eliminated the Holy Land, but also took this particular lifestyle of precariousness, of sufficiency, of sojourning and stewardship, and made it universal. No longer could you be at home in any particular place. And that's very consistent with what we read in Deuteronomy, that you live in a style of sufficiency and precariousness even when you're in the land. The idea is that you do not come in and own and manage and forget, but you come in as a sojourner, one to care and tend for the land. And one's work is for the health of the community, but it also includes the health of the place. It's a cultivation of place and neighborhood and community. And that eventually will lead us to what we'll talk about Friday, the topic of, our English word for the cultivation of place is agriculture in the broadest sense. Now I'm going to stop here. I don't feel like I've made the connection real good between work and place. And so I'm going to apologize for that, but we're going to stop and take time for to talk about it. I hope that our discussion Friday will make that connection a little clearer in our context. But it seems like our dilemma, and the one that we finished talking about, was that our attitude toward work is not shaped by our faith, and part of the problem seems to be that our mobility and our inability to settle in a particular place or to have the resources of a place in a community of faith to help us make the decisions about work have been part of the problem. Any questions or comments?
I don't think it comes to Joel at all. The point about needing to maintain a wilderness attitude when you're in the land, that seems so applicable for us today. Are you going to cover that any more specifically?
Perhaps on Friday, but at least in the discussion we ought to cover it. And that would maybe summarize conversion in that one, no matter where one locates, in the wilderness or in a place, whether you're landed or landless, the important is to have a wilderness frame of mind. That's what it means to be, in one sense, to be converted. Yeah. Does anyone have anything else on that?
Struck by remembering back to Kathy Gordon's husband's on Chief Seattle and how it was difficult for Chief Seattle to understand how we could say that we own land and buy land and how, I don't know why I thought of that, but it seems like you were making a distinction between us being owners and us being users of something that was given to us. And that's, it seems funny that Christians should see themselves more as owners, and Native Americans who don't necessarily share our faith should see themselves really in a more biblical way of users of the land and caretakers of it. It just seems so strange to me that they would be closer to what the Bible was saying than we would.
I think the same thing's true about the South African culture that I read from Steve Biko's book,
mm-hmm.
that the communities there, you know, it was the community's land and no one owned it,
mm-hmm.
but it was for, like you said, community health, that everyone worked together on it.
Yeah, and it was immigrants from the Christian Western Europe who changed all that. The question might seem apparent from that most ancient cultures had an understanding of stewardship and care of the earth. And the question is not, how do we recover our biblical roots? Well, that could be one way to ask the question. The other is, what's happened to us who have claimed to be Christian, where we have no sense of place anymore?
Mm-hmm. Seems like we have such powerful gods, I mean, other than God. Seems like people who are simpler have to be more in touch with the earth. That's where they get their bread from. But we have machines and we import it from other countries, and it's we don't see the connections anymore.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All flesh is grass.
Yeah.
But nobody sees that anymore. They're your basic city person believes that a grocery store provides all their needs.
The turkey's mined from a freezer and not raised on a farm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That connection isn't there anymore.
Okay. What we said Monday, maybe that's the closest connection we can find. Work means is to make this connection between the earth and daily bread. That's one of the most important things about work. And I've never seen my work that way. Work is to do something to get money in order to buy you know, to go down and go to the shopping malls, you know, to visit the Dales.
Does that tell you how cheap food is in America? It's very cheap compared to what it takes to actually produce it, even using machinery. Our food is very cheap.
Well, is everyone feeling the sort of alienation that they're a sense of place is lacking?
I'm feeling I don't know what to do about it. Like, we can't all move back to the land. But I don't think you're saying that. I'm just confused.
Well, I'll say it Friday.
If every Christian decides, let's get back to the land.
Yeah. Well, there is a movement afoot these days that talks about that, and it may be searching for a place. You know,
I think it's hard when you don't see the land in big cities. Even seeing earth is rare. It's all cement, and that makes it difficult.
Or even when we do see it, it's for recreation. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's for
not a vital
aesthetic.
Part.
Right. It's just kind of on the periphery.
Yeah. Where I come from, it's the object to cover as much of it as possible. And if you're not covering it, you're ripping out from somewhere else the gravel underneath it to cover it.
My experience has been just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
In the church that we are involved in, with community gardens and people going back to the earth
mm-hmm.
in small ways, seeing how much we can produce of our own food in our own backyard gardens, and spending hours and hours out there and having dirty fingernails and being in touch with our roots again. I think that there's a large movement in the church to getting back to the earth, to start. I see quite a bit of hope for returning to a more basic kind of a lifestyle towards taking care of our resources and
mm-hmm.
towards getting away from commercialism, trying to get away from materialism.
Mm-hmm.
But is that in the church? And then what about the rest of society? That's what I am concerned about. I see that as having the control, and that is not having the hope, and that is not directing us to the earth.
I just think back over the last couple of years and being in school, and the difference it was for me to live on campus for several years and have my food provided in the cafeteria every day, and then to move off campus in a house where we had a small garden, where we gave our compostables to our neighbor who fed them to the chickens, and then we got eggs from them occasionally, and how much more it made me feel a part of place and the satisfaction that came from working with the garden and being, and all of a sudden becoming an integral part of that community as a neighbor. And just looking at that, I wonder what our education system, the way that we are educated, does for that in our feelings of place, because of it's so common to live on campus in a way that's so removed from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting flip side to that is the way we treat a lot of our older people by taking them off of the farm, out of the small towns, and putting them either into a nursing home or a senior citizen high-rise complex or something like that, or even out their own home and putting them into a big tower someplace
mm-hmm.
And giving them pre-made meals and taking all that sort of responsibility away from them. And the effect that can be seen there is real dramatic when
mm-hmm.
that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time looking at going to the earth as the answer to our problem.
Mm-hmm.
I look at to go straight to a dependence on God, that being the key, the central factor that binds all the discussion I've heard together. Going to the earth makes one live a more precarious life without the benefits of modern convenience found in, quote, the cities or in the more urban dwelling. And to go to the earth in itself is just a way, maybe a way that one forces oneself to get more dependent upon God, but in itself, just going back to the earth for the sake of itself can be idolatrous as anything.
I was thinking about his question of, or his saying, wait a minute, this escaped me again, but it isn't just going back to the earth, but how did we get to the position where we feel that we can just continuously suck up Mother Earth dry? I mean, we do, and we sort of have an attitude as a nation that we can just do what we please. And I've heard that Christians have been accused of being the reason, Christianity is the reason we feel like we can dominate the earth, meaning destroy it or use it all up or whatever. And I don't know how we got to that point where we, and I think that's the real problem. And it's not a worship of the earth, it's just a stewardship of the creation. And I know some environmentalists that literally worship the environment. I mean, they are godless in the sense that only the earth is their god. And I don't see us coming to that, but I don't know how Christianity can, or people can blame Christianity if they understand Christianity for the situation that we're in.
It's true that many have.
They do.
Have blamed Christian theology because it has said that humans are free to use the earth. And what we have in Western nations have meant by that is that we're free to use it in any way we wish. And that is not particularly biblical.
That's exactly what James Watt says and claims that it is Christian.
The question for me is, it is going back to the land, is the idea of recovering something of our roots or living close to the earth, is there anything that's specifically Christian about it? It has the markings of a fad. It also reflects probably some very basic human kind of needs. But the point of Christianity is not always to meet every single basic human need. There's always some sort of precariousness in the call to follow Jesus. And the question that's always been for me is that is there a way that being converted really radically affects how you look at your place and how you respond to your place and to your work, like we're talking about money. And I don't know if I can defend it as well as I'd like, but my conclusion on that is that unless I am committed to a place and understand a place and stay in a place and come to know it and know the kind of peculiarities that a place has, I am not in a very good position to cultivate it and care for it. And I have found that my education, that my profession as a pastor has made me one who is concerned about a very small part of human existence. And has cut me off in a lot of ways from people who have supplied my needs and people who I am caring for. And my knowledge of the world, you know, the whole world, is very partial. And I find that's not shalom, that it is not informative, it's not shalom, it is not a knowledge of my place that enables me to care for it. I don't know if anyone else.
I don't want to get into Friday's session, but I can see what you're saying as a challenge to what Mike is about to do in becoming a doctor and a specialist, where he spends his entire time concentrating on one aspect of care, but doesn't probably know anything about other aspects of care. And, you know, is there something inherently wrong with that kind of specialization where you're out of touch with, and Mike and being a doctor is obviously going to be out of touch with gardening or agriculture. And most pastors are out of touch with just about everything else.
Amen.
Is there an implication? I don't know. I don't think it necessarily has to be that way. But
I guess, but if the church is a community of all the different types of occupations coming together, mm-hmm. shouldn't we be able to feel a more complete shalomness through the interacting of all the different people that are involved in the different parts of life?
Okay.
That it requires time to be able to understand the different parts, but and also an understanding of how to be able to share the part of life that you're involved with in a meaningful way, I think, with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one of the requirements for that is that it that you can live in a situation where you can come to have a sense for what other people are doing and how they contribute. And you don't know them as just specialists, but you know them as human beings too. Does that? I mean, that's what a church is supposed to be doing. At least we talked about that Monday. It's a community where it's a community decision about the occupations we have and about how one contributes to the good of the common good. And it should be probably a very personable and very, very communal sort of feeling about the contribution of occupations to community health.
Well, I don't think you get any more communal than being a doctor. I mean, it seems to me that that's, or a pastor either, because how can they be considered out of touch? I don't consider them out of touch at all. That's, I guess I'm thinking about all the gifts.
For me, to think, and it goes back again, it's missing the point to say, you know, to be to be a specialist or to be a generalist or whatever. It's an individual doing what God's will is for them, and God being able to work through any situation in the city or in the country, or being a doctor or being a carpenter or a plumber or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, there are no bounds as to what one should do if one's doing God's will. I mean, no bounds as to one, for me, I don't want to make any goals for myself, whether that be going back to the earth in itself,
mm-hmm.
if not for, if that's God's will for me. If I'm doing God's will, I can fit into whatever God's plan is for creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to break it down to going back to the earth or anything else.
Yeah.
So it's more a change to have a correct attitude as you look at things, instead of saying, well, you have to, you know, behave this way, and maybe go back to the earth or do something organic or what have you.
I guess
it's your attitude, it's how you look at things, how you look at the community and people, instead of, well, he's a specialist, well, I'm impressed. You know.
For me, it's just a complete dependence upon God. I don't say I've attained that. I'm working toward that. But if you completely trust God that he'll work things out, then that's the thing to strive for, and not the going back to the earth.
But that will involve saying no to something.
Definitely. Definitely.
I mean, one of my problems right now is thinking about the computer age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can God work through a computer? And what happens if we continually, as we are now, create a computer society where everything is done by computer? You know, do we at some point have to say no to that?
Can God not work through a computer?
I don't know, but it seems like you're stating that question that way. I mean, can God work through a nuclear weapon?
I think
so. Where do we say yes or no? If God can work through anything, then everything's great, and we never say no to anything.
But are we all doing what we think the will of God is for us? I mean, that's where the break is. It's not in individual nuclear weapon.
The
God can work through anything.
One of the things that came up Monday was the idea that to choose to work and make those decisions about what is God's will is not an individual decision. You know, that may provide some sort of a check on that.
Mm-hmm.
Say that again. Can
you get that? The question of what is God's will for your life is not a question that's answered, that's best answered, or that can even be answered at all by your own rumination on it. But that it's a job for the, it's a communal task and a theological task. It's one that you enter into dialogue and seek God's will in the community for the common good. Okay, and I think it's at that point that doing theology together begins to say no to some things.
But when does that take place in society? When do we have communal discussion to determine?
Well, I don't know. It troubles me that it doesn't happen.
When do we come to start
thinking? I'm on the fence at Danvers.
I think it's hard for me to figure out a community. I think back, and I can't say I have one at all. I've got some parents who live here and some friends who live there, and I don't feel that I have a community. So I, because of that, I say, well, it's up to me to do it. And mm-hmm. You know, what is my community? How do I define that?
Yeah, how would you? You're asking that of the group, not just of me.
Oh, right. Yeah. And I think a lot of us, because I think it's easy if you're married, you can say, well, my family is my community. Mm-hmm. But that's not good either, because it should be greater. And being single, we don't even have anyone, really. Uh-huh. And if we move a lot, and if we've just graduated from school and looking for a job, there isn't even a place. So it's kind of, you're on your own.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. And
that's how I feel. The first immediate thing you could do is to ask other members of our community of faith, no matter where they live or how long you've known them, you know, to talk about it with you. But I don't think people understand that as a responsibility of being a Christian is to enter into a community decision about the work of others. I don't. At least it's a new thing for me, you know, that you would ever come to me and say, I'm concerned about career, you know, or what I'm going to do, and that I have a legitimate stake in that. That's, you know, I'd say, well, don't you have a placement counselor at PLU, or you know, what was your major? You know, we just don't have real good
ways. Even that pastoral sense, that's not generally true.
Well, the answer used to be pastorally. Well, I don't know, but I have this fourth grade Sunday school class that I need you to teach. And I'm sure God will, you know, that'll make up for anything that you... And Tom mentioned that the Catholic parish in Texas that is now dealing with that, on the one hand, saying that it's not possible to be in this community of faith and build weapons of destruction. And if you choose not to do that, we will take care of you. That doesn't happen very often in the churches.
I also see some individual element in it, such as the community did not decide what Moses was supposed to do, or like Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I hear from you, it's a lot of the community decides what we do,
mm-hmm.
and not the individual. So do you see a balance, or do you see a community?
Well, I would tend to emphasize the community because we do it so much the other way.
Okay.
And I guess I tend to regard Moses as a special case. And he didn't want to do it anyway. That seems to characterize those people that get called as individuals. And they always raise up their family responsibilities, you know, their community responsibilities as excuses.
And Jonah didn't want to do it either. I'm picking up on that element because I still see God calling people to be doctors, pastors, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So it is not always a community decision.
Yeah.
That's interesting because sometimes a person will choose something that they're just really not contributing to the community as their thing. And if they don't get feedback from the community, they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
but need that, the worth of the community, need that be the deciding factor?
That's my question. The common good. Well, what other factors in your work would you look to?
Might the community be an heir and what they need?
Is a prophet or
sure.
An idol smasher?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, it's hard because if your community, let's say it's a church, and you go off and you do your job may not even affect the people in your church. And how are they going to say what they need, and you're going to go off and not even affect them?
Mm-hmm. That seems to be a problem of place as well, in that your work, the consequences of your work are never come home.
Sometimes they may, but sometimes they may not.
Uh-huh. And that may be one of the reasons we've fallen into the disregard of occupation as a theological issue, because nobody ever, I don't have to deal with the consequences of Mike's work because I don't know where he's going to be a doctor or anyone else's work. I just never see the consequences. And, you know, the lack of mobility and the commitment to a place would automatically make someone's work everyone's business, right? I mean, it is here at Holden Village. No one decides here. You know, it is a little artificial because the staff coordinator tells you through the mail what you will be doing. But even if that were not the case, what you did here would have to be decided as a communal issue. Right?
And the balance for that would be that the individual and the community is in touch with God's will. Because sometimes the community decides, okay, we need a missionary, we want you to go over. That's a complete fiasco.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's what I'm saying, is it's very close to man session, and the community doesn't decide you, but invokes the gift within that individual. I mean, the individual has the gift.
Uh-huh.
It's the community's job to evoke it, and when it is something that's destructive, the community also discourages it. I mean, and that's why I see the bishop in Texas as being such a breakthrough, because...
As being what?
I think that's a breakthrough in affirming something and discouraging something else, and drawing on a Christian faith for that, rather than just saying, well, whatever you do best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the weakness might be that it's hierarchical, that it's coming down from the top rather than a decision of the community. It may be more of a dialogue, and that may be what you're trying to emphasize, that a person comes and says, my gift is singing, and the community says, well, sing, and after you heard them, you come back as a community and say, are you sure? You know, it's that sort of give and take.
And then the emphasis on God.
That God.
Involving God in the decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a dialogue and prayer.
It's 20 after 10, and it's time for break, right? I have here an essay that would be the basis of the discussion for Friday, and I think it will tie the two issues together. It's a way to introduce you to the writing of Wendell Berry. If you haven't read anything, you can take the essay and read it. If you plan on getting the book, this is the title essay from the book. You can, or if you don't like the article, you can give it back to me, and I'll find something to do with the paper. Okay, because it is a lot of sheets here. I still feel like I haven't done real well in making a connection between place and work, and I think that this may be of some help, and we'll continue discussing Friday.